Robert Morris Sr. died on July 12, 1750, 3 months into his 49th year. His will is astounding for its length, its detail, who was included and who was left out. It was in reading it that I found the basis for A Wife in Watercolor. In his endearing words, recognizing a woman named Sarah Wise, and his passing mention of two slaves, Yeary and Jackson. B.B. Champ, in the author's note in her historical novel, A Wife in Watercolor. Welcome to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. In the author's note, B.B. Champ goes on to say the record of women in Western history is sparse. Through the 16th to 18th centuries, very little is written by women, about women, and nearly nothing about women of the lower classes. For me, Sarah's story needed to be imagined. My guest today is B.B. Champ, a prize-winning Eastern Shore writer. And we're talking about her excellent historical novel, A Wife in Watercolor. Barbara, if I may use that term, welcome to Delmarva today.
Well, thank you, Hal, if I can use that name. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Barbara, I'm honored that you're here to talk about your new novel. Barbara is almost a passing mention in Robert Morris Sr.'s will. If I'm correct, she receives £250 current Maryland money, which is tobacco money, really no good outside the area, two silver pint cans, and six silver tablespoons. Let me ask you, why, in addition to the fact of the paucity of written material by women and the lack of material about them in literature that you cite, what else compelled you to imagine and write Sarah's story?
Well, you know, Sarah is an enigma in history. She's just a name in a will, which is a unique will for the time. And I had to go explore who she was. And it turns out that she became not only his housekeeper, Robert Morris Sr.'s housekeeper, but his concubine, and had his child after his death. I think in researching Sarah, both at the NAB Research Center at Salisbury University and the Maryland Archives, I found so little about her. But what I did understand was that she was little more than a servant to him initially. And what does that mean? You know, it's not a part of the human condition to exist in servitude and bondage, and for little pay or no pay at all. And what it was like for her and for Yeary, the intersection of their two lives in his home, how they had to depend on each other for survival, how they had to use their friendship, because they must have been friends of some nature to have existed so closely in a small home. And so, for me, it was a story that needed to be told about two women who began as friends of a different color as something else.
How did you research Sarah? Where did you find material on this woman? She was neither indentured nor a slave. She was a free woman. So in your research and in your imagination, how did she become connected with Robert Morris?
Well, you know, I found his NAB Research Center, and she is mentioned directly in the will, and he mentions her lovingly, actually. And Yeary and Jackson, two of his enslaved peoples, are also mentioned. And it just brought me up short that there was just nothing else about them. So before the pandemic shutdown, I went to the Maryland Archives. I was so lucky. It was one of the last months that you could get in there. And I began the birth and death records, through the court records, through the bastard court records. And the only thing I found, because there are hundreds of women of the time named Sarah, and very few of them have their last name connected to them. It's always connected to a man, but you don't know. And her name in the will is Sarah Wise, but nowhere did I find Sarah Wise listed. The only sound who could have been her was in the land records for Island Creek, a piece of property that Morris owned, I believe. And in the 1750s, after his death, she purchased, a Sarah Morris purchased it. And I have to believe that it's her, because the Robert Morris Inn was owned by an overseas master, Foster Cunliffe and Sons. And she would have been homeless again, could have been homeless very quickly.
So women could purchase property and own property at that time.
Well, you know, at that time, his son, Robert Morris Jr., the financier of the American Revolution, had received his father's very great benefit from the will. And so the question would be whether he really wanted to keep all of those properties and the chattel and merchandise and everything. So in my mind, he knew Sarah. He lived in that house for 2 years with her. And I think that very possibly he came to her rescue and made sure that she got that piece of property.
How did you come to write about Robert Morris Sr.?
Oh, well, that is an interesting story, because in about 2011, I was visiting Oxford at a time when they still had a plaque up by the Custom House that listed the prisoners from the Battle of Culloden. These men were offloaded at Oxford and were set up for indenture throughout the land, throughout Talbot County. And when I turned around and looked at the inn, of course, there's that wonderful hanging sign with the portrait of Robert Morris Jr. on it. And I'm trying to put the two time periods together. And I'm thinking to myself, well, whose inn really was it? Because that's a different generation. So I went back and discovered that Robert Morris Sr. was the great tradesman on both sides of the Mid-Atlantic of the Chesapeake Bay. He was unrivaled in his ability to command, to begin capitalism. And Oxford was second only to Annapolis at the time in terms of trade. So this gentleman, known far and wide, and by the time of his death, he had 17 warehouses up and down the Chesapeake Bay. So it seems to me that I had to find who he was, because so little is written about him.
Your depiction of Robert Morris Sr. is not always a complimentary picture. I found him in your novel not a particularly a likable man. How did you imagine him like that, Barbara?
The writings of Jeremiah Banning, who is a Revolutionary War figure and who lived at the time of Robert Morris, much younger than he, and he was his great admirer, influenced me a lot. And one of the things that Jeremiah Banning said was that the people, the landowners of Talbot, spent a great deal of time at their dinners discussing how they could punish their servants and slaves in a multitude of different ways. And it broke my heart to read that. And he followed that up by saying he was sad. Often the women of the household were included themselves in those discussions. Jeremiah Banning was a slave owner himself, but at his death, he freed everyone and was ashamed of his partaking in that time period. And he said it was so strange that everyone just felt like it was acceptable. So here was a man, Robert Morris Sr., who was the agent of Foster Cunliffe and Sons of Liverpool, and they were known slave traders. So he helped facilitate slave trading along the Chesapeake. And that can't be a happy experience. And I can't imagine what old Oxford that doesn't exist anymore looked like. But it was, there were 300 residents or more of the village and then the outlying area. And everyone was used to seeing 50% or more of the population were people of color. So Robert Morris was, while he was admired for his trading capabilities as a man of great mercantile brilliance, at the same time, he fostered one of the great sins of the founding of this country.
I still want to ask, Barbara, what you had in mind as you decided, I'm going to create this story. What is it in your mind at the time that compelled you to write, to a great extent, Robert Morris Sr.'s story and Sarah's story, as well as some of the others in your, what did you want to tell us about that period?
I think that people change, just like Jeremiah Banning did, that people gain an awareness of how horrible this engagement in human trafficking was. And certainly by the end of the century, it was a sentiment that was held not just in the North, but many people in the South also felt that way. And often there were run-of-the-mill people of middle-class stature who held an enslaved person in their home, one or two, or one and a child, an adult and a child. And they lived in very close quarters. And they were dependent on each other. In that kind of scenario, there had to be moments of friendship, of understanding, of helpfulness, because they had to survive. And it wasn't easy to survive in those days. They were thwarted by disease, by outside privateers, by worries about the French invading. They had a lot of anxiety. And so I wanted to portray a time in a group of people who were not part of the ruling class, but were dependent on each other for their survival and who formed reliances on each other. And that's where Yeri and Sarah exist. And at one point, Yeri even says, when she looks at Sarah, she thinks, she's more of a prisoner than I am. So I think it goes both ways.
You write about very strong women And I just have to feel that that was also in the back of your mind. To talk about women, not just in that period, but almost as a metaphor for the strength that women can bring in very, very difficult circumstances. And if you agree that I'm right in that, where did these women, Yuri and Sarah, and later in the novel, Greet, where did these women find their strength?
Well, I don't think they all came by it easily at the very beginning of the story. Sarah has a lot of weaknesses. And one of them is that she is paralyzed by her own intellect. She's a smart woman, she's educated, but often when she sees something that's wrong, she freezes and is the one who has to say to her, stand up, be the person I know you are. Go bury that baby. It's your fault. You could have saved that child. And because of Yuri, Sarah learns and she becomes stronger. Yuri is a woman who is an unknown to Sarah in many ways, even though they've been brought up together, slept together, and supported each other through the years. But Yuri's strength comes from being a part of an underground world of indentures, other slaves, Native Americans, who all are trying to survive. She sees the world differently than Sarah does. Her world is bigger than Sarah's. And little Greet is the orphan child who was initially raised by a Dutch home, or thinks she was, and ends up with the Assateague and the Nanticoke in the swamp, the Great Cypress Swamp. And she exists, that's her early experience. And it is one of intense survival. And she's flippant and irreverent. And when she enters the home of Robert Morris, she shakes it to its foundations. These are women that I have known. You know, every writer writes what they know. And these are composites of women I know.
Well, there's one exchange that I wish you would tell us about that I found quite impressive and quite revealing. During the attack on the city by the Scotsman, and I believe this is a man that Sarah has huge respect for and almost love. For
this, almost
the Scotsman. And while the city is under attack, he says to her, it's not just freedom I ask, it's a future without doubt. Someday, he's saying to Sarah, we'll have our own Plemeniman, a wife to honor my estate. And Sarah, eyes open now, tells us, I blinked in disbelief. To honor his land like a prize racehorse? There were so many contradictions bound up in him. I wouldn't lay my future at his door and think it brought me freedom. What happens to Sarah in that moment?
Well, you know, here she's lived with Robert Morris, who is the epitome of greed and early capitalism, the mercantile genius of the Mid-Atlantic. And Sarah has benefited with beautiful clothes and and all these accoutrements for her dining table. And she begins to see that maybe she could have more, you know, tangible things that she could have more. And maybe this was the promise of her parents when she was born. But now so much time has passed in this story and she's learned so many lessons that she looks at him and thinks, you know, at one time, all he wanted was me to ride with him into the swamp and live with him there amongst a very diverse people. And I couldn't leave. And now he wants a Plimhimmon for himself. Now he wants a great estate and me to be the fancy lady standing at the door. She realizes that money and fame are not going to provide her freedom because she's already learned that lesson, that it's come with great responsibility and binds, ropes that bind her hands, her thoughts, her feelings. And she knows that this is not going to be her future.
Let me ask you to correct me, if you would. But when I read this, my eyes opened in your novel. And I saw Sarah seeing herself as chattel to Robert Morse. Yeah. And all of a sudden, she sees now that she would be little more than chattel to this man as well, like one of his prize racehorses.
That is true. That is undoubtedly true. When the story begins, she's stealing coins. She's swiping valuable things that he won't notice. And she's tucking them away in her hidey hole in her garret room as insurance to a possible future where she can have some control, where she can live on her own, because she's not happy being his housekeeper. And at this point in the story, as she's standing there with the Scotsman on the harbor, with the ships burning, she realizes that she would just be trading one position with ties that bind for another one. And she wants more. And the reason why she does is because she's seen the life, the secret life that Yuri leads.
Well, I was very impressed and moved by the characters that you created in this story. And you did that to some degree out of whole cloth. Sarah, even though you knew a little bit about her, Sarah and Yuri and Greet. But I'm wondering how you come about creating such human characters. And by human characters, I mean they have faults, they have strength, but at the same time, they make mistakes. And that is fairly constant through the novel. You get the sense that these are real people that we're reading about here. Tell us how you worked that out with them.
Well, you know, Hal, I have to tell you, I spent 34 years in teaching high school, and a great deal of that time was working with the school admissions review and dismissal committee, where we looked at students who had great difficulties and weren't succeeding and had to make a decision about what kind of program. And so I was always the one who was charged with writing educational evaluations. And sometimes I would have to take a deep dive into their specific folders there. And I learned so much about the human condition from doing that. So that influenced me. But also, it's just been in my humble existence, an act of observation wherever I am and looking at individuals and what their motivations are. And the motivations that are the American experience that created us, the moral clarity of bravery and kindness and sheltering of those who have less than us. And those characteristics are the ones that we so need to see now in our human experience as a nation. And I really wanted to perpetuate that in these stories, in this story, and in these women. And even Robert Morris learns. He by the end of the story, he has some consciousness of what his sins are, and he wants to do better, only it's too late.
There is also not just harboring that knowledge and that insight into the human condition and the human mind, but putting it on paper is an act of creation. And I thought you did a very good job.
Thank you.
In the creating part of these characters. Another aspect of your writing, Barbara, that I really appreciated in this novel, not only what the character development and the sense of these people and their circumstance, but also kind of a narrative strength in the writing that I thought carried throughout the novel. And I wondered if you would read a paragraph for us that kind of touches on this narrative ability.
Well, sure. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Hal, that's great. I have a piece here that is in Yuri's voice. And Yuri is returning from the tavern. She's been sent over there by Sarah. It's late at night. And she was supposed to be looking for Robert Morris Jr., who has disappeared, and they can't find him. And Yuri has a moment where she starts to think about her condition, about her place in the world. And she says, "I turn back to the safety of my slave cabin. At the door, I be overcome at its dearth of comfort. Jackson be a mound snoring under poor Hestia's ratty quilts and Voltaire's leg hanging from the attic ledge that covered in hay. Coals glow on a hearthstone, giving no heat to a room riddled with cracks, frigid night air seeping inside. This be my future in Sarah's care. I grumble and vow never again to sleep inside with her like we did as girls, but her slave. Her baby coming to steal her focus and be my work. A white woman's child ain't nothing but trouble to a slave like me. And if history be any prediction, this one won't have no father neither, whether it be from the Scotsman or the master's seed."
Thank you, Barbara. A part of Robert Morris' residence is incorporated in the Robert Morris Inn that you mentioned earlier in our discussion. I don't believe anyone now, after reading your book, A Wife in Watercolor, could visit Oxford and the Inn without feeling the weight of the presence of the slave Yuri and the Morris concubine Sarah Wise. Barbara, thank you for joining me this morning, and thank you for an excellent historical novel. And thanks to all of you for listening. This is Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.